Our next speaker, who is Professor John Davis, Professor of Pediatrics at Cambridge. Professor Davis.
Ladies and gentlemen, it may strike some of you as a little ludicrous that an elderly gentleman should be talking to an audience consisting largely of young women about what it feels like to be a baby. My only excuse is that my orders came, as Spencer Haggard put it, from she who must be obeyed, Mrs. Sheila Kitzinger. Now, there are two ways of approaching what I'm trying to say. One is the intuitive, and the other is the observational. That is, we can look back in what de Tocqueville called the dark mirror of the mind to the beginning of things, if we can, or we can look at babies and see how they behave and draw inferences from that. Now, what I'm mainly going to be talking about today is the latter. Do we have any information about what it may feel like to be a baby since the babies cannot express themselves in speech? And of course, why I'm at a peculiar disadvantage in talking about this is that I believe, with my mentor Donald Winnicott, that women around about the time they give birth are in a peculiarly sensitive state to empathize with their babies, and they know a whole lot of things that scientists are only slowly catching up with. That's why I shall come back to the intuitive. But now, just a few things about what it might be like to be a baby. As Freud pointed out to Otto Rank, there is no way in which we could expect a baby to remember the birth experience in the sense that we remember events that we've been involved in. If the baby remembers at all, it isn't as a spectator, but it is as a participant. And we do just have a little evidence about that, though it's difficult to know whether memories dating back that far are of a Pavlovian kind, or, for instance, recorded and analyzed in any way in the cerebral cortex, which is only just going to be, if I can put it that way, colonizing the baby from above down from birth on. When I was working in Manchester, one of my assistants, Elizabeth Dryberg, got interested in the fact that an anaesthetist had told her that when he was trying to anaesthetize babies needing surgery at about the age of a year or 6 months on, most of the babies put up very well with having a mask put on at their face and the anaesthetic induced. But a small number became immediately frantic, and it was extremely difficult to induce the anaesthetic for that reason. And it occurred to her that this might be because they'd had a previous experience of having a mask put over their face at resuscitation at the time of birth, and that this awakened a kind of body memory of an unpleasant event. And when she came to explore this, she didn't find actually that hypothesis was proven, but what seemed to be very clear from the figures, and I haven't time to put them up in front of you for you to analyze for yourselves, what seemed very clear was that those babies who'd been badly asphyxiated at birth, however they had been resuscitated, became those babies who struggled against the imposed asphyxia, if you like to call it that, in anesthesia later on. So that some birth memories perhaps do survive in some shape or form. The next bit of evidence I borrowed from another of my colleagues in Manchester, Malcolm Chiswick, who unfortunately is not yet in a position to publish it. He wanted to know whether the conventional lie detector, which measures what we might call conductance across the skin, could tell us anything about the state of mind of babies, particularly babies round about the time of birth. And to put it crudely, the greater the conductance, the greater the state of arousal of the baby. And not surprisingly, I suppose, he discovered that babies immediately after being born showed, by this means, if that's what it reflects, a high state of arousal, which gradually wore off over the next few hours. Babies born by elective cesarean section did not show this effect, at any rate to the same degree, indicating that they had probably not been aroused by that experience to the same extent. Next, and interestingly, the least aroused of the babies born by the normal route were those whose mothers had not required or not accepted any anesthesia. But they were more aroused than the babies born by section. If he compared different sorts of anesthesia, he found that Entonox caused little more arousal than no anesthesia, but pethidine and, interestingly, epidural anesthesia, very considerably more. But this probably reflected the fact that the women who'd been given those agents had been longer in labor, and therefore their babies might have had a more difficult experience. Now, what we can't do is to extrapolate from those findings into the baby's state of mind, or try to draw a lesson about what we ought to do, because there's a good deal of evidence that it may be a good thing for a baby to be aroused to a certain extent at birth, because that is concerned with the adaptation of the lungs for the first breath and independent breathing thereafter. On the other hand, we might say that too great a state of arousal cannot be good for a baby, and here I come to other evidence not directly concerned with birth. The evidence collected by Professor Ainslie Green and Dr. Anand about the reactions of newborn babies requiring surgery to the surgical procedure according to whether they were deeply or shallowly anaesthetized. And I might sum that up by quoting Shakespeare for a moment and saying that babies, like Jews, as Shylock in this passage was describing, could say, if you prick us, do we not bleed? Because it became quite clear from Ainslie Green's findings that if you inflicted painful procedures on babies with what turned out as a result of the study to be not adequate anesthesia, then they had very violent physiological reactions, which are no doubt in some way appreciable by the baby in psychological terms, and are also actually bad for them in terms of their well-being. So probably too much arousal would be a bad thing, and not enough arousal would be a bad thing, and we should follow the Greeks into thinking that moderation in all things is the best motto. But of course, what you're concerned about is whether being born at home or being born in hospital conditions is better or worse for the baby. Just as an aside, because it isn't my brief, I'll say that I know of no convincing evidence that babies are put at more risk of mortality or morbidity by being born at home in general, though it is quite obvious to common sense that in certain circumstances some babies would be, and it's probably true that in some situations that isn't predictable. But what about the positive side of things? Because one of the things that I suspect disturbs us all about the modern world is that we value everything for their secondary qualities. Why do I like this uncomfortable nylon shirt? Because it's easy to wash. Why do I eat my supper out of tins? Because it's easy to cook. Whether it tastes nice, looks nice, wears well, seems now to be put into second instead of first place. And we might therefore say we need certain citizens in the future whose experience of coming into the world has been as good as it possibly can be, because it's those fortunate individuals who are going to be the generous individuals who, so to speak, carry the rest of us on their shoulders later on. So that I am in favor of aiming at the ideal. Now, one hopes a slide will come on. Yes. This is a picture of a newborn baby drawn by the baby's own mother 20 minutes after she'd given birth to it. And most of you at first glance will think this is a very charming picture. But I will suggest to you there's something wrong with it. I don't know whether you are thinking to yourselves there's something wrong with it. What's wrong is that the baby is in a kind of almost semi-comatose sleep. And Martin Richards in Cambridge was saying to me the other day, you neonatologists have never seen a normal baby after birth, because the babies we see are largely babies like this who've been born in hospital and are under the influence of the drugs that were given to their mother for good or less good reasons. And so normally, the normal baby is in a state of moderate arousal at birth, like the babies I described to you, born to women who hadn't had deep anesthesia of any kind during their labor. And this is a hospital baby sleeping off a hospital birth. Now we'll move on to a blank for the moment. You will note that I've said nothing so far about so-called bonding. And I don't think I'm going to address that question because I'm very skeptical about it as a term. Winnicott said there is a bond formed between mother and baby which takes hours, days, weeks, months after birth. It doesn't suddenly happen by a midwife bringing a baby by the scruff of the neck, clapping it on the mother's bare chest for the regulation 3 minutes and going away, as I've seen described in an advertisement for an American maternity hospital. Bonding available 5 days a week. Nevertheless, I think the early relationships between a mother and a baby are of crucial importance for the baby developing the capacity for personal relationships later in life. You will remember when Freud was asked what he meant by maturity, he said the ability to love and the ability to work, the ability to relate to persons and the ability to relate to things. These are extremely important matters. Does the place of birth or the kind of birth have any bearing on that? Well, my colleague in Cambridge, Lynn Murray, has been studying what happens when you artificially perturb the transactions that go on between mothers and babies very early on in life. Most of you will have indulged in these kind of semi-conversations, which often men or women not maternally preoccupied regard as often rather ridiculous, because the mother is saying quite complex things to the baby and interpreting the baby's replies as quite complex things too. Anyway, what Lynn Murray discovered in this context was that if you perturb such a conversation by shifting its time scale between a normal mother and a normal baby, this upset the baby in a way that was easy to photograph on a video and get a kind of record of. And she then noticed that if you took such a transaction occurring between a mother who was depressed and her normal baby, exactly the same thing happens. And so we might begin to ask ourselves, is it a really bad thing for the baby that the mother should be depressed? And are the circumstances in which women go through pregnancy, labor, birth, and the puerperium, which is likely to make them more depressed than they otherwise would have been? Because if that's the case, we are conniving at something that is not a good thing as we see it. If I come back to the place of birth, perhaps I could say something like this. That at least some, and maybe most women, feel safer in their own homes. They are territorial animals, other things being considered. And that most obstetricians feel safer in hospital because they are territorial animals. And the question is, how do we strike an appropriate bargain between the mother who wants the obstetrician to provide safety and the obstetrician who is laying down on what terms he will provide safety in those circumstances. Now, I promised I wouldn't be too long, so I shall go on to my next slide. And this is to do with the intuitive side. You remember Winnicott saying, there is no such thing as a baby, there is only such a thing as a nursing couple. And it takes a great poet to get back to what things may be really like for a baby at the beginning of life. The infant new to earth and sky, what time his tender, it should be, palm is pressed against the circle of the breast, has never thought that this is I. But as he grows, he gathers much and learns the use of I and me, and that I am not what I see and other than the things I touch. So runs he to a separate mind, from whence pure memory may begin, and through the sense that binds him in, his isolation grows defined. But at the beginning, he is not isolated and should not be isolated, and it may be true, as Winnicott once said, that psychoses of some kinds, at any rate, are the results of deprivation, not of food, but of a particular kind of love. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Davis. Our next speaker is Lee Stewart, who is the president of Knapsack in the United States, and who is mother of five children, all born at home and all without medical assistance. So welcome to Lee Stewart.
On Thursday, May 16th, a baby was born in a small college town in Missouri in the USA. This baby was not born in a hospital. A doctor was not present. The baby was born in a small home that had been made from a garage. There were only three people present at this birth, the mother, the father, and the baby. At 5:20 p.m., after about 6 hours of labor, the baby's head emerged, and the eyes opened and blinked to get used to the light and to see where he was. With another contraction, the rest of the body emerged gently, being supported by the father's hands. The baby took his first breath and let out a cry at the drastic change of environments. As the baby lay in the father's hands, stretching and looking around to see where he was, the father said, "This child will see all of his brothers and sisters born." Well, this was a new thought to the mother, I can tell you, because I was the mother. But I was to see the wisdom of this statement and see the fulfillment in it, because all of our children have attended all of their younger siblings' births. As you know, this was my birth, and Jonathan, our oldest son, is with me today. He's 24 years old, so that was over 24 years ago. David Stewart was my husband, and he was the father who caught the baby, and he would very much like to be with us today. He's back home taking care of our business and our other four children. David is the executive director of Knapsack and the author of several books, by the way, that are available in your bookstore here, and several articles on childbirth, home birth, and midwifery. He is a PhD, by the way, with a background in mathematics and physics, and who has done a lot of work bringing scientific and statistical credibility to the safety of home birth and midwifery. I was fortunate enough to be born at home, but David was born in a hospital. He was separated from his mother for 10 days during the regular hospital stay back then in 1937, and he was denied breastfeeding because of inadequate information given to his mother. Somehow, though, he knew there must be a better way by the time that it was for he to have his family. During that first pregnancy and afterwards, we were asked, why would we risk an unattended home birth? To tell you the truth, at that first birth, we did not tell very many people because we knew that they wouldn't really approve of what we were doing. Some thought the reason was money, but I can tell you that it was not money. We didn't have any. No, we still don't have any, but that's not why we had the baby at home. We decided the reason that we had our baby at home for that first one and subsequently the other four was because we thought it was safer. And that may sound strange to some who think that safety is why women go to the hospital, but here was our reasoning. And it's the same today. Drugs given to the mother during labor and birth are not good for the baby. The small town where we were living, all mothers were giving drugs. In fact, all mothers were totally anesthetized and knocked out. Statistics at that time showed that 1/4 of all babies that died because of too many drugs given to the mother during labor and birth. And I was told several years later, when NAPSAC was forming back in 1976, he said, it was a neonatologist who said that. He said, the statistics are the same today, by the way. We reasoned that if drugs were causing that much death, they were also causing brain damage and other problems. Number two, and this was very strong feeling with me, since I'd been born at home and I had been there when my brothers and my sister were born, and I thought babies should be with their mothers. But I had heard that babies were always taken away from their mothers in the hospital, and I felt that babies should be with their mothers. There should be no separation, and if there is separation, I felt it would cause trauma and possibly psychological damage. At the hospital where we would have gone, babies were routinely separated from their mothers at birth. There was no choice. There was no rooming in. Dave wanted to be present at the time. Fathers were not allowed in the delivery room. Why? Because it was too small for my then 135-pound husband. So we had our baby at home because we thought it was safer than the hospital. We knew that if we were at home, some problem may happen that we could not handle. The hospital, though, was 5 minutes away. We felt that a healthy pregnancy with attention to proper nutrition and preparation with education about birth would assure us a high probability of good outcome. However, if we went to the hospital, there was a certainty of drugs during labor with unknown consequences, separation of mother and baby with unknown consequences, and the separation of the father with unknown consequences. Since then, I've learned what some of those consequences are by hearing other people tell stories. So you tell me, if you had the choice, which you may have felt was the best probability of good outcome. Why didn't we have a birth attendant? Because there were no birth attendants available if we wanted a home birth. Our choice was a hospital birth or an unattended home birth. And by the way, that is still the two options that are available to many families these days. And I feel like that is what this conference is all about, and that is the reason that NAPSAC exists, to try to ensure that the option of home birth includes a properly trained attendant and proper backup in case we need help. Now, back to my husband's statement that this child will see all of his brothers and sisters born, siblings at birth, family-centered birth at home. I can tell you about it, and I can tell you that properly prepared children have very positive reactions to birth when it is natural and normal. I can tell you that it will be a high spot in their memories, and Jonathan could tell you the same thing. In fact, our children at one conference spoke about their feelings about being present at the birth of the other children. It's a special time for them. I can tell you that if you involve your child with pregnancy and birth, that your child will be more likely to accept the new baby as part of the family and be happy about it. But I'm going to show you. We made a film at our last birth. It's called Anthony's Birth at Home. We can't show it all. I would like to show it all because it does show the interaction of our children throughout the birth, of them peeking in and out and, you know, then coming in at the birth. We're going to start right at the birth where I called the children in, or I tried to get my husband and someone else to get the children, but they thought maybe that they knew better when the baby was coming. I mean, this was only the fifth child, you know. People learn slowly. I'd just like to talk just a little bit about the preparation of children. I'm not going to talk very much, just to give you instances of sort of children's reactions at birth. I never will forget Laura Lee. She's our daughter and our second born. I never could convince her that I was carrying a baby inside of me. I try to tell her and get her to feel and so that she could, you know, be prepared when our son was going to come, and she knew how it was going to be. And I'd say, you know, there's a baby in here, Laura Lee. And she'd look at me kind of sideways. She was about 3 years old. She'd say, yes, Mom, there's a baby in me, too. She didn't believe me. And then when Keith was born, and he sort of tumbled out, you know, in a little ball, and she said later that she thought that was a turtle. So she wasn't too traumatized. And then I remember Keith. I thought that his comment was so funny. When our fourth baby was born, and Keith was almost three, maybe three-year-olds have it for funny comments. And as Ben was born, and Keith was so excited, and he said, oh, look, Mom, he's naked. Well, so I didn't tell him that, you know, babies wouldn't have little clothes on. That's interesting. Or maybe little glasses or something. Okay, now I would like to close with the film Starting at the Birth to show the reaction of our children. Jonathan was then 12, Laura Lee was 8, Keith was 5, and Ben was 2. So you get a nice spectrum to see, and I will end with this film.
Done or needed, we could only guess the baby's position, but the baby was actually born posterior, as you can see.
Not crying.
No.
Before, my friend.
It's not crying.
It might need to be helped. Might have some set in its throat or something. Get a pad over here so he's not laying.
Yeah.
Is he still breathing?
Yeah, he's still fine.
Hurry up, honey. Let me hold my baby. Oh, baby. Oh, that's my boy. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Did you see that?
That's my baby. Well, yeah. Oh, look at all that vomit.
Yeah. All the kids ran in that.
Look at all that vomit.
Look at all that blood.
Face up.
Face up.
Face up. Oh,
he actually come out posterior?
Yeah.
My boys don't know how to be born, do they?
Yes, he's a boy.
Yeah.
There's five boys now.
Look what Nana. He's a
he can't see.
Pulsing it all.
That's a baby.
That's a baby.
The baby, yeah.
What's that one thing?
That's the umbilical cord.
Oh, that's how the baby gets fed, Keith.
Before it, oh, up, that's where it got its foot came through that
foot.
He's just born. Did you see the time, Jay?
About 12:13.
He was just born, honey, so he's a few minutes old.
Well, now, Jonathan, as an expert at birth, having seen 4 other births, how do you think this went?
I think it went pretty good.
Very sick.
The nipple's not in his mouth. He's getting
an idea. Smack, smack.
Got to come here first, sweetheart. Looky here.
Hey, Mama's back here.
What?
That.
Look, let Jay take. Look here. Look at Jay. Get over there so he'll look at you.
That's the baby?
Mm-hmm.
No,
now. See if you'll swallow. Look at it sucking on his finger.
Yeah. Awful babies. I won't get close.
Now, why don't you give him a smile? This is for Dr. LaBoye.
Who cares? Is he looking at you?
He sure is. He's looking all around.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Tell me newborn babies are blind.
Sure. We knew that from the very beginning. They were not blind. They see. They see their mama, and they can see their daddy, and they can see their brothers and sisters. Yes, and their photographers.
Lee, would you like breath, Arson? Can I have your Bradley cocktail here?
That good?
Thank you.
It's warm, I hope. It's warm. Okay, pull it down. And now, Jonathan, tie the cord right here. Cord has been cut.
Keep it in there.
Daddy cut the baby.
Well, yeah, now the baby's all by himself,
isn't
he?
Just cut the cord, honey. He didn't cut the baby.
The vessel he was having.
No,
did you know that my daddy, yeah, he helped to born me. Yes, he did. And my mama said he was right there by her side. Well, let me tell you, my daddy.